Hello, you're listening to The Sower, a podcast of the Ciceronian Society. The Ciceronian Society exists to equip and encourage Christian scholars as they serve the church, believing that it is the church that is the center of cultural and civic renewal that we need. To learn more about us, our events, our journal, Pietas, to sign up for our newsletter and make your tax-deductible gift, please go to ciceroniansociety.org. We have a very busy year ahead, so please stay tuned. We got our fall symposium, October 22nd through the 24th in Holland, Michigan. Our 2027 spring conference will be at Regent University in Virginia Beach, March 11th through 13th, and the proposals for that are due September 1st, 2026. We'll also be launching the Logres Institute for Classical Studies this fall. I'm Josh Bowman, Executive Director of the Ciceronian Society. Before we go any further, I'd like to open with a prayer. Heavenly Father, we ask that in the name of your Son, Jesus Christ, you would bless this conversation, and that guided by your Holy Spirit, all we say and do would bring glory and honor to you. Amen. Today, I'm very excited to be joined by my friends, John Pinheiro and Dylan Palman. John is the director of research at the Acton Institute. He was professor of history and the founding director of Catholic Studies at Aquinas College previously. And his newest book, edited with Dylan Palman, is The Christian Roots of American Liberty, which we will talk about today. He also has the award-winning book called Missionaries of Republicanism, A Religious History of the Mexican-American War, published by Oxford in 2014. I highly recommend that. And the American Experiment in Ordered Liberty, published by the Acton Institute in 2019. Dylan is a research fellow at the Acton Institute and founder and president of the Nicholas Cabasillas Institute. He is author of The Kingdom of God and the Common Good, Ancient Faith, published in 2025, which we actually talked about here on the SOAR podcast back in 2025, and also a book called The Foundations of a Free and Virtuous Society, published by Acton in 2017. Again, he co-edited the book that is the topic of today's podcast with John, and it is a source book charting the prehistory of American founding principles through the ancient, medieval, and early modern worlds. So welcome to the show, guys.
Great to be here.
Thank you.
I see that, John, you have the book I just mentioned in the intro next to you. I did read that. This is the book on the Mexican-American War, right? That was published in 2014?
Yeah, 2014. I've written two books on the Mexican-American War. This is the second one, and this one deals with American identity and American religion. So it's a religious history of the war.
Right? Yeah. I remember I actually read that book for I did my dissertation on Thoreau, and I was trying to get more information on the perspective, the context, the historical political context he was in. Your book did not help me, but it was really, really interesting. I just want you to know, I thought to myself, this guy's onto something. So I recommend that book to all of you.
Thoreau is in that category of anti-Mexican war.
Right.
But also a pacifist, sort of, I thought I mentioned Thoreau in that book.
You did. Though,
because he had a very different, very non-pacifist approach to the Civil War, which didn't seem to match up well with his Mexican War emphasis.
Right, right.
This was common among New Englanders involved in those wars and who thought about slavery and other major reform issues.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's a whole different podcast. We should bring that up on the podcast at some point, but that'd be good. Well, all right. So, guys, we're talking about your book, The Christian Roots of American Liberty. It's a reader published by Acton. Got a bunch of different sections here. And I want to just start with the basic question of why this book and why now? Why a book on, is this just, well, hey, it's the 250th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. Let's just throw this out there. Or is there something deeper behind this? Why the Christian Roots of American Liberty? Why now?
Well, I could say, from my point of view, this began, as I mentioned to you before we started recording, it began as a paper for a conference a few years ago. Kind of the background behind that is we organized it, this panel on kind of liberty before liberalism. We wanted to show that, a lot of these ideas are not just like Enlightenment inventions, that they come from this longer history of ideas, and in many cases, a very Christian history of ideas. So I wrote a paper mainly focusing on ancient and medieval sources, but by necessity having to get into John Locke and the American founding a little bit. And then we kind of expanded that to be the introductions. There's five sections to the book, and there's an introduction to each section as well as a general introduction. And then And then we added all these readings. And so the need that we saw then, I think it's very true even today, is that there's been at least a trendy sort of movement to try to frame the relationship between Christianity in America and liberalism as in some way antagonistic. So either it's, you know, the American founding was Christian, therefore not liberal, or, you know, a Christian point of view can't be liberal and the American founding was liberal. So the American founding has problems. And, you know, depending on the writer, you know, Patrick Deneen or Adrian Vermeule or Yoram Hazony, or we could have, we didn't mention them in the book, but we could have mentioned Stephen Wolfe and the Christian nationalists. They kind of have a similar sort of perspective. They're all saying, even though they have very different goals, very different perspectives, they all actually share in common this idea that the basic institutions of liberal society, including American society, are incompatible with Christianity. And I think anybody who actually knows the history of ideas knows that that's a ridiculous claim. But people were buying these books. Patrick Deneen's book was, you know, his Why Liberalism Failed. That was a bestseller. Obama put it on his reading list and everybody bought it and read it. And I think, you know, the average person does not read those sources, nor would you expect them to. You know, why would you be, you know, if you're working at an office, you know, you're not reading Lactantius in your spare time. And that's fine. Right. But the problem is people were just kind of taking their word for it. And so we really wanted to make something that the average person could read. Right. That it's not a long book. It's maybe 250 pages, something like that. And instead of not only making this argument that we think these people are incorrect and mistaken, but we actually give people the sources so they can read them themselves. And it's not like whole sources, although a few of them are. We do have like the whole Magna Carta in there, for example. But a lot of times it's just selections, just a few chapters from a particular historical source, just so you can see, well, here it is. You know, here's that. You know, affirmation of religious liberty or private property or limited government in the ancient era, in the medieval era, in the early modern era, all from these Christian sources before you even get to the American founding. And, you know, our goal is not to say that therefore all this stuff is the only possible Christian point of view. What we're just pushing back against is the idea that the only Christian point of view is the opposite. The reality is much more complicated. Of course, there are, you know, trends of, you know, illiberalism in the history of Christianity and autocracy and whatever, all that bad stuff. But that's not the whole story. And we want the whole story to be told. So that's why we put together this book. And then the fact that it is America's 250th anniversary this year makes it a really good year to publish a book about America.
Yeah. And John, would you add anything to that?
I would add to that that as an historian who was a history professor for about 20 years, I used to use primary sources in all my classes. And I was never happy with the readers that were the most popular on the market. A series like the Major Problem series, if you're familiar with that, or maybe some of your viewers will be familiar with that. And it's not that they're bad, but each of these came with essays that told you how to interpret the sources before you read them.
Yeah.
They came with the sources all chopped up. The probably the most egregious example was Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from a Birmingham jail, which one reader I considered using had edited out all mention of Augustine and Thomas Aquinas and kind of this Christian sensibility of law. And it becomes this letter about why you should just protest against the man. And I thought, no, you want to give them the full sense. Like there's this deep Christian background to the civil rights movement, of course. Mm-hmm. But imagine generations of students cycling through in Americans, and they're never told any of this. They don't see the primary sources. All they see are their professors at some very good schools. And Dylan, you named a few professors at very good schools. And we don't want you to take their word for it, our word for it, your textbook's word for it. That's why primary sources are so valuable. And not anyone can just sit down and interpret primary sources the way maybe a scholar can who gets the whole context. But on the other hand, we tried to choose sources, some that are very famous, very obvious, like the Magna Carta. But those famous, obvious ones might be ones that you haven't read, but you've only referred to. mm-hmm. and you haven't looked at them in years and years, maybe over a decade. Others may be less known, like some of the medieval church canons and the primitive constitutions of the Dominican order and Fortescue. And there's a number of them in here. And yet these tell the story that Dylan was describing. So what we'd like folks to do is pick up this reader and read these sources for themselves, read the little bit of background we provide in each section, and look at America's founding principles and say, you know what, these, if I'm seeking to conserve the permanent things of which America's founding principles touch on those, then that here's the long pedigree of those things. And it turns out they weren't invented in the secular Enlightenment. But it also turns out the United States wasn't founded on a particular brand of Christianity that's only for white Anglo-Saxon Protestants. There's a very long heritage. It's both historical and in terms of ideas. And that's what we try to present in the book. And like Dylan says, it could be, we could have made a book three times as long, but we think we have a pretty good selection of courses here, of documents here. And that whole history comes together in this distinctive way in the American founding. But that's not to say we're making an argument that Americans, we're not making the American exceptional argument in the way others might make it. We'll just put it that way.
Gotcha. Well, Dylan used the word liberal a bunch back there. And as a political philosopher, I always get uncomfortable, not because I dislike the word necessarily, but because what do you mean by it? Right. Because there's so, especially in the American context, it is such an abused word that is almost meaningless to a point. I'm wondering, Dylan, just starting with you, when you say liberal, what do you mean or liberalism in the context of this reader?
Yeah, that is a great question. That's something that we start the book defining our terms. So I'll just read what we wrote there. So we use the terms liberalism and liberal to refer to the theory and institutions of liberal society, grounded in a conception of human persons as by nature free, equal, and rational, and thus that justice in human government requires the consent of the governed and religious toleration. This definition is broad and neutral enough to hold for most, if not all, liberal societies today. And then beyond that, we talk about American liberalism. So I think a lot of the writing about liberalism today is way too general. Either people say liberalism is good and they throw everything into that bucket, or they say liberalism is bad and they throw everything in that bucket away. And the reality is there's a French liberalism and a British liberalism and an American liberalism and a German liberalism. And there's commonalities. There is a general category. There's also very specific, distinctives. American liberalism and French liberalism are very different, especially when it comes to their perspective on religion. If you don't understand that and you're just combining sources from these different contexts, you're going to have a very strange reading of things. And I think that's happened way too much. So we get into the specifics of American liberalism. You know, if you read the Declaration of Independence, it starts by talking about God and providence and the author of nature and natural law. These are pretty distinctive things in the American tradition. They come out of that British liberal tradition that all of our, founding fathers were a part of. But they're also very uniquely instantiated in the United States. And so that's what we're talking about. We're talking about a certain anthropology that has political and social implications built into it.
You guys know I'm sympathetic to this, but let's pretend I'm not for a second.
Sure.
In the sense that when you're still applying liberal in this broad way, which I think is important, but liberalism as you're discussing it, you could argue doesn't really emerge until I believe there's like a political party in Spain that first uses it in the way that you're talking. I want to say like the early 19th century. I don't have my sources in front of me, so correct me if I'm wrong. But in terms of liberalism, right? Can you look at all these sources? I mean, you're going back all the way to the early church and beyond. I mean, why is this not an anachronism? Is that liberalism? Is liberalism a kind of is it a word we give to something that has existed for centuries? Or are you imposing on older sources something for your convenience, right? Essentially, well, let's just turn these older people into liberals so that we can justify what we're saying. And yeah, John, you were going to say something?
Yeah, sure. I think your question gets at the very purpose for providing a book of primary sources. And so the book's title is The Christian Roots of American Liberty, not The Christian Roots of Liberalism. Right. And so there's a lot of different ways we could approach liberalism. An historian I find very insightful is the Catholic English historian Christopher Dawson. And Dawson wrote a lot about this in the 1950s and 1960s. And one of the things he said was that there's no less intelligible word in the English language, even democracy, he says, than the word liberal. It can cover such a wide divergence of elements. And I think that's true. So, but when you talk about emerging, that's an interesting word. When you talk about roots and you think about plants and how they grow and how they emerge and flower and the, you know, different branches, et cetera, what we're looking at is we're taking those things that are commonly accounted part of liberalism, like consent of the governed, civil liberty, religious liberty, representation. We're taking a number of these things in sections of the book, and we're saying these things have deeper roots. They weren't simply invented in the United States. They weren't invented in the 19th or 18th century. They have deep roots, not just into the early modern period, but we go back to the earliest church fathers. So I don't think that's the same as pushing our interpretation on past ideas. So what we're not saying is that Lactantius was a liberal, or that the clerics who wrote the Magna Carta and made the king sign it, that didn't last long, but you know, the Magna Carta did, but not, that's a whole story there. Right. But we're not saying that those people were liberals, but there is an idea of liberty before liberalism. And we see it even in Spanish Jesuits like Juan de Mariana, who's talking about no taxation without representation. Mm-hmm. And there's not, I don't think there's any American, even the Catholic ones in the 1780s, who would compliment a Spanish Jesuit as a liberal. I've been working, I just completed a chapter on John Adams for a book I'm working on. And I realize I have to write a whole essay on his anti-Catholicism. but I don't want that to be the chapter.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of a typical New England sensibility that, like, here's the illiberal point of view and here's the liberal point of view. But what we see in the United States today, if this book is to be relevant, it's that those older anti-Catholic arguments about whether Catholics could be good Republicans in a Republican, lowercase r, of course, nation, and that the answer was no, those now come from Catholics. So yeah. That's part of the intended audience. Those for whom those who might find that compelling because they don't know the sources or don't understand the complexity, as Dylan said, that's part of the audience, not the only audience, but certainly that's part of the audience.
Dylan, would you add anything to that?
So, you know, I think, you know, I mentioned we use the terms liberal and liberalism. I think it would be anachronistic to call, you know, Lactantius, you know, a figure of liberalism. But there are liberal elements to his thought. And I think that's an important distinction, right? If you are saying that because people are by nature free and equal because they're created in the image of God, that therefore you should not be able to compel their conscience, that's a liberal idea. Liberalism did come afterwards in terms of systematizing this, labeling it, but the elements were there. And I think most people would be very comfortable saying that there is a liberalism to the American founding. I don't think it's the one and only one, again, to get back to the point I made previously, there's really no other word for it, right? They all love liberty, and their understanding of liberty and human nature leads them to, you know, some very impactful actions, whether it's, you know, declaring their independence, constructing a certain type of constitution, whether it's things like, I regret we didn't include the Northwest Ordinance in here. I feel like it should be an honorary founding document because I live in the Midwest, but there's things in there, you know, it talks about life, liberty, and property, and there, you know, it forbids slavery. And there's things that you can see flowing out of a very, very similar, if not the same in some cases, understanding of humanity. And, you know, what we do here at ACTIN, we really stress that everything comes back to your view of the human person. And that's true all throughout history. I think this book illustrates that really well. Our namesake, the British historian, Lord Acton, he was a Catholic and a liberal. So at least in his case, the two could go together. And his big project that he never finished was to trace a history of liberty. And he went all the way back to the ancients. And we very well could have done that as well. But we just wanted to address this question of the compatibility of Christianity and liberty in the American founding. He has a whole essay he wrote on the history of liberty and Christianity. He says, you know, there's something about Christ's statement to render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's and unto God the things that are God's is absolutely revolutionary in terms of human history. And I think he's right about that, that even in the worst Christian polities, they still had to figure that out. They still had to say, well, wait, the state can't be everything, right? Because otherwise you're rendering what belongs to God to Caesar. And so this book is kind of in his spirit, right? In the spirit of Acton, that we're bringing these sources together so that, you know, hopefully many more people will be talking about this long history of liberty. And maybe one last thing, you know, we talked about, you know, John talked about, you know, the roots, right? Acton said, among many other very quotable sayings, he once said that liberty is the delicate fruit of a mature civilization. Mm. And I think you see that in the American founding. These were educated people defending their rights that were long fought for. You know, we see, again, we have Magna Carta in there. We have, you know, Blackstone. We have, you know, some other kind of precursors to that. But we also have an issue today where it is a delicate fruit. It's still a delicate fruit. And we don't always have the kind of civic literacy that we need to have and that we used to have, just as evidenced by the fact that a book like, you know, Why Liberalism Failed could be a bestseller. And nobody says, hey, I don't think this guy understands John Locke or the American founding. Mm-hmm. Well, get our book and you can read John Locke himself and you can read, you know, The Federalist and you can, you know, some of these excerpts and these, in some cases, whole texts. And you can then pick up his book and see how he did. You don't have to take our word for it. You can judge that for yourself. So that's kind of how I would address that, yeah, liberalism, if I'm trying to say that, you know, Justin Martyr and John Locke have no differences, then yeah, you should be very suspicious of where we're coming from, right? Yeah. On the other hand, there are some commonalities, and it's really important to acknowledge those and to be aware of what they are and why those commonalities exist.
One of the,
I could add, Josh, just quickly, it's not just a matter of commonalities, but it's a matter of evolution and ideas growing over time and changing and altering to specific situations. I mean, compare, you talked about French liberalism versus American liberalism, for instance, and you'd have to really think strongly about historical context and church and noble corruption in late 18th century France. I mean, there's a lot of things to take into account. The kinds of things that puzzled Tocqueville when he decided to visit the United States and wondered how you could have religious freedom without religious wars, and wondered how you could have freedom without with such a relative lack of laws, as in positive laws, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, trying to figure those things out. Lord Acton said that what he called, so you got the delicate fruit quotation, Dilla, which is a good one, but he also talked about liberty as the highest political end. That's often misinterpreted to think that Acton and liberals in general in the late 18th century saw liberty as the goal itself. And so that if we were to look around America today and we see civilizational things that even those with whom Dylan and I might disagree on their interpretation of the founding, we certainly agree on the problems, mm-hmm. like certain issues in our society, radical individualism, a sense of radical autonomy, which always empowers the state and not really the individual, that ignores associationalism and all the good stuff Tocqueville talks about. But what I wouldn't do is put that on the heads of the 55 men who were at the Constitutional Convention. what I would say is when they have an understanding of liberty, if you go through the OED and the definitions of liberty, they really give you definitions of libertinism more than anything else. And that's commonly not the 18th century understanding of liberty. It certainly wasn't. It wasn't Lord Acton's either. Liberty was to allow you, in Acton's words, to pursue the higher objects of civil society. So it's not an end of itself, in other words.
For those of you who are slow like I am, when he said OED, he meant the Oxford English Dictionary. It took me a second. I'm like, is that a government agency? No, I'm just kidding. But I want to add.
Tolkien wrote some of the OED.
That's right. We're fitting in really well. And I wanted to just go on a quick tangent here, because one of the things I think is interesting about that's kind of going on in an academic space, if you will, is because Lord Acton goes back to these classical sources, I know, and others have too. So the recent book, or last few years, by Michael Hawley, Natural Law Republicanism, and he focuses on Cicero as this key source, I think in a very compelling manner, Cicero as a key source of the liberal tradition going through to the all the way to Locke, being a huge influence on Locke, as well as the American founders, et cetera. And Carrie Netterman goes and looks at the Middle Ages and how Cicero's influence might be bigger than than Aristotle's. Now, I think he may take that too far, but it's an interesting debate that, you know, do we really need Christianity to get to the liberal values that we do appreciate? I think Lord Acton and others show that, yeah, you do need Christianity, because Christianity gives you much richer anthropology, a much richer and more accurate cosmology, I think is another way to put it. Another source that that came to mind was back in 1978, Quentin Skinner published his Foundations of Modern Political Thought. And a lot of people, including Skinner himself, focused on his first volume, which is more on the Renaissance, Machiavelli, etc. And he wrote a book also, Liberty Before Liberalism. And, you know, one of the things he shows unintentionally, I think, in the second volume of that book is how so many of the emerging modern notions of liberalism, which I don't know if he says that exactly, but have their roots in early Christian ideas, especially teachers, Catholic scholastics, in which he if he just follows the sources, as a good intellectual historian, he cannot deny and does not deny in that book, at least the second volume, that many of the things that we value in a modern Enlightenment liberty sense have their sources in Christian ideas, especially the canon lawyers, things like that. But there's a curious thing. I want to complicate this here, because is there still a danger with connecting Christianity to classical liberalism? Now, I'm saying this as the Protestant on the call. So we have a fun group here, very Ciceronian, a Catholic, an Orthodox, and a Protestant person all in the same room. And I'll just, you know, hey, I'm a Protestant. Aren't we the problem, right? We take that liberty and just run with it in a theological sense, right? So, you know, you already said this to a point, Dylan, that you know, Lord Acton is misunderstood sometimes as seeing that liberty is an end in itself. He's not. That's not the goal of liberalism, simply to be free for its own sake. But is there a danger from a Christian perspective if we overdo this? You know, where does the Christian draw the line? Do we tolerate everything, everyone? Is private property absolute? How limited of a government do you want? Because if we limit that government too much, we're in trouble. I mean, heck, the Protestants might keep creating denominations or something if you don't limit them to doing, you know.
That would never happen.
So I guess I'm wondering, like, you know, in writing this as Christians, where do we see the lines, if anywhere? How do we prevent liberalism's excesses?
Yeah, so no, that's a great question. And of course, there are people today, there are liberals who don't want there to be any limits. But that would be a very anachronistic reading of the American founding and certainly of any of the sources in our reader. Mm-hmm. Actually, I think there's a logic to our sections of the book. So there are five sections. The first is on natural rights and natural law, mm-hmm. And then religious liberty, and then private property, then checks on state power, and then lastly, democratic consent. And in the conclusion of the book, we tie these together to show, you know, that kind of what is unique about American liberalism. It's again not very long, so I think it's worth just reading here. So one, human persons created by God in his image with equal natural dignity as free and rational beings require the rule of law as a matter of justly giving to all their due in accordance with natural law. So natural law, for readers who may not know, is the innate sense of right and wrong, kind of Ten Commandments morality that is written on the human heart. You see this in Romans chapter 2, the church fathers, and we highlight some of them. They talk about this, the correspondence, the basis of the law itself, the Ten Commandments, the way in which people were able to recognize it as good is because it's already written on their hearts, right? St. John Chrysostom, we have a passage in here where he even talks about how the Sabbath gets an explanation because it's not as self-evident, right? So he's like, do not murder. God didn't need to say, do not murder because it's wrong, because you already know that it's wrong, right? And so that's the idea. So that's the limiting principle, if you want to know. I don't think a free society that wants to have religious liberty needs to tolerate Aztec religion, for example, which practiced human sacrifice. Maybe if the Aztecs want to reform and no longer do that and still have some kind of religion that's traditional, okay, right? But there are limits. That's the limiting principle. And I guess I could keep going. There's four more points, but I think that actually gets at your question, so I'll stop there. Really, the limit to liberty is natural law. And that was pretty... if not universal, pretty widespread in the American founding and certainly in the history of Christianity. When people talked about liberty, they did not mean licentiousness. And to throw a bone to our Protestant listeners and to you, probably one of the most prominent Protestant traditions in the American founding was Puritanism, which is not exactly known for libertinism. And I would challenge anyone to read the sermons of Witherspoon, one of the American founders, who was also a pastor and taught at Princeton. You will not find a libertine there, but you will find someone who loves liberty and who loves liberty specifically because he is a Christian minister.
Witherspoon had a few very important students, right, who played a strong Indeed. Role in the founding. So that's a good example. I'd answer your question by referring to what Dylan mentioned earlier. That is, at least when Dylan and I start, as we're thinking on this book, and I'd say Acton Institute in general, we always start with the human person, because if you get the human person wrong, you get everything else wrong. But there's things that we know, especially if we follow the Greek wisdom and look within and know ourselves, and we ask, like, are we perfectible? Are we perfect? Are we good? Do we aspire for more? Do we want to know what's true, or do we not care what's true? And if we care what's true, that's a sense that we know where we were created to seek and know the truth and to grope for it. When you're telling me something, Josh, I want to know whether you're telling me the truth or not. I want to investigate it. I want to think about it. So when it comes to your question about Christianity and how this figures in, that anthropology is so crucial in the development of individual liberty. So we find that, for instance, that because of the our sinfulness, whether we read that as part of the tulip or whether we look at it in a Catholic way or an Orthodox way or some other way entirely, we know there's an issue, right? Yeah. And, James Madison touches on this when he talks about factionalism being a problem of the human heart, and we can't eradicate that. We could eradicate liberty. That might stop it, but that's not really what we want to do. So how do we get at that? So what we find is this is why we, on the one hand, this is the reason we need government. But on the other hand, this is exactly the same reason why we need limited government. And you put a few thousand years into thinking on that, and you get the ideas and the sensibility of the American founding. In terms of limiting principles, it would be from anthropology then that I would draw a moral line. So if you can't objectify the human person, then I think you could easily argue that slavery should be illegal because it's wrong. And here's why it is wrong: because you've turned a human person into an object. I think you could argue, I would argue, we have a diversity at Acton Institute and I'd say in the liberty movement in general over prostitution, legalization of drugs, anything dealing with the human person and objectifying others, pornography, certainly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Make it illegal. I have no that would be easy for me to argue as a Catholic who believes in liberty that those things should be illegal, and here is why. Private property, and this you two can correct me if your Christian tradition is different, but at least the Catholic Church teaches a universal destination of goods, but also indicates that private property is the normative way that we shepherd God's creation and guide it. And we know that there's private property going back to the Ten Commandments because we're told not to steal. And you can only steal something that's not yours, which means it must be somebody else's, which means it's their property. So we could have written a book on the Jewish roots of American liberty, and there actually is such a book, but it's not our book. I think there would be an very interesting Greco-Roman roots of American liberties, though some of the Roman would be, I think, also Christian roots of American liberty. But that would be an interesting book too, kind of the pagan roots. John Adams loved Cicero more than he loved Aristotle. Thomas Jefferson couldn't stand Aristotle. There's among the founding, you're going to find more people who are drawn to Cicero and those late Republican Latinized Stoics than you are going to find drawn to Aristotle or Plato. I mean, easily, hands down.
There's a lot of interesting, roads we can go down there with the Jewish and the Protestant side of it, right? You have the whole tradition of covenant, right? Covenant being a Jewish tradition, but also being very much part of really all the Christian traditions, but also the Protestant tradition, very much part of the compact, constitutionalism, right? Development there. And the pagan sources, if you will, there's we actually interviewed him last year, Carl Richard, a brilliant historian down at one of the schools in Louisiana. I can't remember which one. Great scholar. He's done a bunch of stuff cataloging the Roman and Greek sources of the American founding. I cannot recommend his work highly enough. He's also done a bunch on the American founding and their uses of the Bible as well. So there's a lot to say there. And the private property piece is particularly interesting. I think when I just think of the attitude my students have had to it when I was a professor was, to them, and this is the success of kind of this residual Marxism, if you will, is private property just sounds like greed. It just sounds like something like this is mine and you can't have it, right? But what we're saying is like, no, look, this is how we shepherd these common goods that come down to us. It's not an excuse for greed and stinginess, and it's not a license to not be generous, right? Especially as Christians, we are required to be generous. It is part of who we are supposed to be. I'm wondering though, if you can, how do you connect religious liberty and private property specifically? Do those two go together? Why, they're in the same book, but are they related in some way?
Yeah, great question. So something we point out, we have, as I mentioned, the whole Edict of Milan in there. So the early Christians are universally in favor of religious liberty. During the time of persecution in pagan Rome, they are constantly writing to the emperor and to the magistrates, and they're not saying, hey, you should all become Christians and force Christianity upon everyone. They're saying, please just tolerate us like everyone else. In fact, one of the ironies, weird tragedies of what was going on is that ancient Rome was one of the more religiously tolerant societies of the ancient world. But they would only tolerate religions that could demonstrate their antiquity. And so when Christians were kicked out of the synagogues, they said, well, this is a new sect. We know the Jews have been around forever, but who are you? Right. And so a lot of times you have like these extended quotations from the Old Testament in like apologies of Justin Martyr or Tertullian, which don't seem to make any sense because like, why would the emperor even care about what Isaiah says? Right. But the reason why they think he would care is because they're trying to demonstrate that antiquity. So they're arguing for this religious tolerance. And then this unthinkable thing happens that the emperor becomes a Christian in Constantine. And he and at the time, the other emperor, draft this, it's not really an edict, but this kind of declaration of tolerance for the Christians, probably drafted by Lactantius, or at least highly influenced by him. And when you read it, you realize that this actually was not the first such edict. So the Edict of Milan was 313. It refers to one, an earlier edict from 311. The difference between those two edicts, nobody remembers the one from 311. Nobody, right. Nobody talks about it. The church doesn't commemorate it. Well, why? Because that one did not return confiscated property to the church. Mm-hmm. And it did not get people out of the mines and forced labor and all that sort of thing. The Edict of Milan, the reason why the church marks that as the occasion of their freedom in ancient Rome is because it acknowledged the property rights of the church. And within religious liberty, rightly understood, you have really all the seeds of a liberal society. You can't have religious freedom if you can't own your own church buildings or temples, okay, or whatever the case may be. You can't have religious freedom if you can't preach your own doctrines and teachings and propagate them. So you need freedom of press, freedom of speech, and so on. You can kind of go on and on and on, but they're very, very intricately, closely, and necessarily connected, I would say. And I think you, again, see that not only through our argument, but through the very texts that we've chosen in this reader.
I'm wondering then, so that's all really helpful. I one of the things that I wrestle with, especially as a Protestant, is the biblical teachings to submit to authority, right? Romans and 1 Peter. It makes me uncomfortable at times. Like, am I reading this right? And we know there's a whole tradition of this within Christianity, especially, again, Luther's complicated here, Calvin's complicated here. But I'm wondering, does the notion of limited government as you're presenting it here with the sources that you're using and these claims to individual liberty, do they help us qualify, or can we qualify those biblical calls to submit to authority? Because me, I wouldn't call myself a full libertarian until I feel like it, right? It's this, I want to qualify that submit to authority. Do you think in the sources you're drawing on, does it give us grounds as Christians to qualify that submission? Does that make sense?
Yeah. So there's a few things. So one, just biblically, you have in the book of Acts, the apostles saying we must obey God rather than men. Mm-hmm. Right. So again, there's that distinction between there are the things of, in that case, there's the things of the religious leaders, but there's the things of Caesar, or worldly power and authority. And sometimes, you know, there's a higher authority and there's a higher law, that natural law. The way the earliest Christians did that is they submitted to all the laws they could. In fact, they bragged about going beyond the laws with their mercy for the poor. But when there was an incompatibility between the law and their faith, they chose their faith, even if it meant their deaths. That's why we have so many martyrs. So all those martyrs, there's actually a political emphasis to it. You know, of course, they're just dying for their faith, but they're also making a statement about the current regime, the current political order. And then within our reader, we have at least one example, really many examples of, you know, the need for the consent of the governed. I think that factors into it. Again, if people mm-hmm. are free and rational beings, and to be just is not, you know, to give them, render to them what is due, which means not to treat them like objects, you know, they should have some say in the rules of their society. So you have that tradition. We also have a historical example, a very classical one of Ambrose and Theodosius. So the church in Christian Rome, a ton of flaws in Christian Rome, right? Still a lot of, you know, autocracy or whatever. But you know what? The emperor didn't consider himself a god, didn't ask people to worship him. And he actually acknowledged that there were authorities in his own society that he had to submit to. We see that in the case of Ambrose and Theodosius. So there was a riot in Thessaloniki, and the emperor at the time, Theodosius, sent an order to his guards or his soldiers to go and basically slaughter everyone. And that's what happened. And so then he goes to his residence in Milan, and it's time for church. And he comes to church on Christmas, and Ambrose stands at the door and says, "You're not getting in." You need to do penance for the crime you committed. And, you know, he, to his credit, realizes, oh my gosh, you're right. Like, I, you know, that was an incredibly rash thing I did. Not only does he, you know, put on sackcloth and, you know, kneel with the penitents for like a month, which is actually a very light punishment if you know the canons of the church, but still he did something pretty remarkable for an emperor. But also he amended the laws as a result of this. And we see this in the church historians that, that tell the story. They talk about how a law was put into place that if the emperor was going to command such an act, I believe it's like people had to wait like 24 hours or a week or something. They basically had to give the emperor time to reconsider, because supposedly he even kind of like was like, oh, no, you know, cancel the order. And it was like too late, you know, right? So there's actually a change in the law, a change in the constitution of the society that grows out of that Christian faith. And it's something that, that really is a growth. It's not something, unfortunately, that people said, okay, we're Christians now. Here's a liberal society, right? You know, these things have to be learned through time and circumstance. It really is this kind of delicately cultivated fruit. But I think that's a great example of exactly what you're talking about, that of course we need to submit to the authorities. Human social structures have a certain hierarchy to them, just naturally. I think, you know, you can get like the freest minded people together and the strongest personalities will be the leaders. And it just like even people who want to be anarchists, they're still going to be leaders and followers. And that's just a reality. And that's OK. Right. Some of that's by design. God created us that way. So we need to be discerning. We need to respect people who have legitimate authority. But we also need to know what are those limits to get back to your earlier question.
Yeah. Yeah. So the question there is what makes the authority legitimate?
Yeah.
Right. And so that's the section there on consent. This authority question, I mean, we're not going to solve it today and our reader's not going to solve it. And right. This, of course, divides Christians, but the authority question is an important one. You see it in Thomas Aquinas as well, that is consideration. When is it okay to overthrow a bad leader? I think there's this question is such a long one over the centuries that I would point then this is the value of studying history and looking at the historical development of ideas and not just kind of grabbing ideas in a vacuum. The Christian church developed for 300 years underground, illegal, in tension with the state, the Roman state. There are other major religions in the world that don't have that history, where their religious authorities and political authorities are bound up together from almost day one. That kind of history matters, and it shapes the way you interpret scripture, authority, etc. Absolutism was an early modern and really almost modern creation when we finally get to autocracy. We don't see that with Christian kings. So you could just look at Magna Carta, but that's not the only example. Some of the best examples are in French history where the king is clearly weaker than the Duke of Aquitaine. The church is important. The nobility are important. And how do you become an absolute monarch? You eviscerate the church as much as possible or infiltrate it. And you also eviscerate the nobility and get rid of them and create a whole new nobility like Louis XIV did. This is how you get finally to absolutism. And the question then becomes, are all authorities the same? And they're not the same. And if they're not the same, what causes those distinctions? So the tradition that results in America is, of course, the one that's thinking of consent and representation. But there's that Thomistic tradition also of whether the legislation is just or unjust, and how to determine the two. And the unjust law, Thomas says, is no law at all. Those are the ones you can break. This is what Martin Luther King, whom I referred to earlier, drew upon to oppose segregation laws, for example.
Let me finish with, we can't answer this whole question here, but I want to just start with it. Because one thing that's very near and dear to the Ciceronian society is this Tocquevillian question of what role does the church have in civic and maybe we add economic formation? Because this book is, it'd be a great reader for a class on like Christian political thought or the American founding, something like that. But I can also see churches looking to this. You know, if you have the right person to lead a book study, right, at a church. But one of the things, and I know our president, James Patterson, has talked about this in some of his things, is asking ourselves, you know, in a way, one of the reasons that liberalism seems to have gotten out of control in our time, in a way that has gone beyond the limits we discussed earlier, is in James's words, the church failed liberalism. It failed to be the institution of civic and economic formation and moral formation that it was supposed to be. I'm oversimplifying it, I know, but I'm wondering in writing this and looking at these sources and looking at the American founding and in John, especially with American history, how should we think of the church's role in civic and economic formation, if anything, right? Or maybe it's the wrong question. I'm just wondering, and we'll start with John. What do you, in relation to this book?
Yeah. To start with Washington, of whom we have one of Washington's pieces of writing in here, his letter to a Jewish synagogue.
Yeah.
But this is what George Washington is talking about in his farewell address, this very question. If you're going to have a nation of as few laws as possible and limited government, think about the actual real social contract of the Pilgrims in 1620. What I like about the Mayflower Compact is it says, you know, we might need some laws and stuff, but we'll see. Let's just get going. And as we need them, we'll make them. But they don't step off the boat with like a 10,000 word EU-like document of positive law. Mm-hmm. So they're going to depend on the virtue of the population. So Washington ruminates on where virtue and morality come from. He condemns thinking about it. And he condemns philosophizing about it in such a way that would ever argue that religion or morality can just kind of exist without religion. For morality is definitely downstream of religion, Washington thinks. And Hamilton, who wrote the draft, also clearly thinks. Mm-hmm. But they're not the only ones. And so you mentioned Tocqueville assessing the United States, and he's got a lot of reasons for why the democracy works. I mean, he comes to America, right, to find out why is democracy working here and in France. It's a basket case, nuns on the scaffold, priests on the scaffold, blood in the streets, Jacobins changing the calendar. I mean, it's all over the board, right, in the first French Revolution, then right after 1830. Like, what's holding things together? And there's a lot of things he cites, like having no metropolitan city be the head of your country. Washington, D.C. is just a swamp at the time. But he also cites associations, but he cites religious liberty as well. And so if you're going to have limited government, you're going to need a virtuous population. If we can't rule ourselves inwardly and interiorly, then we certainly can't rule others. We learn how to do that on a small scale. We were talking about authority earlier. We ought to also have mentioned the smallest natural society, which is the family, which in most families has a pretty clear authority structure. Now, there will be those Protestants who are going to very much emphasize Ephesians 5, and it's going to seem very father and the rest kind of thing. And certainly Protestant plantation owners were like that, only they throw slaves into the mix. But there's definitely an authority structure. I mean, anarchy and democracy has been attempted in families. Those are the ones who are going to end up in family therapy first, I think. So when John Adams said that this Constitution is only for a moral and religious people, what he wasn't saying is that we're a Christian nation in the way modern Christian nationalists see that. What he was saying is this Constitution requires a population that can behave itself, that has self-limiting prudence and moderation. Otherwise it won't work. So that while in nations with traditions of autocratic rule and serfdom might need the boot of the monarch on the neck of the ignorant population, Adam says, Americans are the most highly educated people in the world. Edmund Burke says this in his conciliation speech in 1775. He warns the English. He says, not only are they educated, most of them are lawyers. And this is an interesting combination, Burke thinks. These are people who really, they know the law inside and out. They like to argue, and this is the way it's done. And they admire the classical rhetoric, especially bringing us back to Cicero, so that in the time period of the early Republic, if you're going to cite anything in a speech to try to get your way, especially in the political realm, it's either classical history, American history, or the Bible. And the Bible is usually number one, classical history number two. And then you're proving that these other two things are true by citing events from the American past. You can't really do this till at least the 1830s or so. There's not enough of an American past.
Right.
But those are what you're going to be citing. And so what we don't want to do is look at this sense of church and say, well, does it mean then that the United States is a Christian nation in the sense of a confessional state, mm-hmm. in the sense of the papal states, or a nation that has a national church? These things were disputed in the 1770s and 1780s. States had established churches on up through Connecticut, which ended establishment in the early 1830s. But there was a real fear, of course, that there would be a national church, so hence the First Amendment. But yeah. I wrote an article recently for the Reading Wheel Review on the Anti-Federalists, mm-hmm. and the history of the religious test that's in the Constitution, and what does it mean and what doesn't it mean. Now, maybe some of those in the Ciceronian society will know that the religion test is avoided if you apply secularism as a religion and then use that to vet out, for instance, candidates who might not vote your way on abortion because you know they're Catholics and they're members of the Knights of Columbus or something.
Right.
So once you turn secularism into a religion but try to pretend it's neutral, it kind of abrogates the religion test. But what anti-federalists were worried about at that time period is that the religion test might mean precluding some Christians and not others. But some mm-hmm. of those anti-federalists actually wanted to preclude and keep some Christians out of government. So they kind of wanted state religious tests, but not a federal one, because they were afraid the federal government would end up with something along the style of the Church of England, which they had just, you know, officially broke from in some way, because the head of the Church of England is the monarch. And they weren't getting along well with King George at the time. Mm-hmm. I'll stop there. But I think Tocqueville is definitely the one to read on the role of religion and the role of the churches. And it's more than just associationalism, the church as just another association, mm-hmm. which would be, I think, a caricature of their liberalism. It's more a matter that kind of formation of the family as the school of love and the first formation of people. But where are those folks formed in the family and the role of the churches in that? So if we were to look at kind of what we around the Acton Institute call the Acton synthesis, is this is the role of clergy and churches to help in this moral formation. That's their role in the Republic. Mm-hmm. It's the role is not one of legislation and politics. Right. Lord Acton himself was very clear on this, that over the long haul, ideas, moral formation, and principles win out over moments of particular legislation, or getting behind the right ruler who's going to do everything for you. And for example, the next thing you know, you're erecting a golden statue. This is a true but recent story.
You're right.
These things can happen. So,
right. Yeah. Dylan, any final thoughts there?
Yeah, so I think I would guess, because I don't know the context, but I guess what James was probably talking about is, in particular, historically illiberal regimes that mm-hmm. Very often had the church's support, and in the cases he outlines, the Catholic Church's support. However, I would say in liberal societies, the reality is a mix, just like, you know, we're trying to point out, not that you know, the only Christian perspective is liberty, but that liberty is a Christian perspective. So, you know, look at the civil rights movement, right? Dr. King was Reverend Dr. King. Mm-hmm. There are many, many pastors involved, churches involved. At the same time, there was criticism from Dr. King and others for, you know, where are all the white pastors? Where are all the, you know, where are all the, mm-hmm. the northern pastors? You know, so sometimes they felt like they didn't have the solidarity they needed. Sometimes there was unexpected solidarity. You know, there's a very, at least in our Orthodox circles, a very famous Life magazine cover of Metropolitan Iakovos of the Greek Orthodox Church marching with Dr. King arm in arm at Selma. Now, one of the reasons for that is because the KKK was burning crosses on Greek Orthodox Church lawns. So it's a very natural solidarity. Right. But you do see there is some unexpected support there. There was what freedom gave our nation was the freedom to have that moral conversation. And at its best, what the church did was guide it. Again, not every church did a good job. Not every denomination, but not even every particular pastor, right? But we had the freedom to have that conversation, to have those disagreements, to make the case and to you know, preach our perspective. You know, I think about Peter Betke, the economist, has brought up the difference between Adam Smith and David Hume on religion. This year, we're celebrating Adam Smith's 250th anniversary of his Wealth of Nations. So a good little plug as well. David Hume did not like religion. He was an agnostic and a skeptic, and he favored establishment in England, which seems like a weird thing for a guy who doesn't like religion. But the reason is, he said, well, with less competition, the church will be worse and fewer people will want to go. Whereas Adam Smith liked religion, and so he favored religious liberty. Why? Because the more competition there is, well, the better the sermons need to be, the more, you know, the church actually needs to be the church. Now, of course, there are, I think we've seen that, you know, that liberty can be abused. Right. You know, you can have the church of easy answers, and you can probably raise a lot of money and get a lot
standing
of
room only.
Right. But I do think the point stands that if you believe your particular church uniquely has remained 100% faithful to the gospel, that St. Paul calls the power of God to salvation, you just need to demonstrate it, right? You don't need Caesar's help. And I think that's been one of the blessings that we've had for the last 250 years in this nation, is that we're a nation where everybody can make that claim and people can judge for themselves. The reality is, as any economist would tell you, is that there are trade-offs. Doesn't mean you're going to get a cult or two. You're going to get some weird guys with some weird ideas. The way you respond to that is by showing that the truth is true, not by forcing someone into submission, you know, unless they're harming someone else and violating that natural law. I would just say, you know, the history is mixed. And I think the people who are setting up the kind of oppositions that we are trying to counter with this book, they want a simple history, and history is just not simple. And it's really important for us to know that history, that's in particular that religious history. We could circle back to perhaps learning the religious history of the Spanish-American War or whatever, Mexican-American War. You know, all of those cases, there are Christians on both sides, we should hear them out. You know, the only way you can hear them out is actually reading what they wrote.
John, were you going to say something?
I was only going to add that as far as Hume goes, he was right about the consequences of establishment.
And look at England.
I don't say that as an idea, but we can look at the history of confessional states, both Catholic and Protestant in Europe, and their empty churches, and also the blowback then that clergy and the churches get when there finally is revolution, because the church is so closely tied to the regime. And that's actually what Patterson has done with Thomas Howell's in their forthcoming book, Why Post-Liberalism Fell. It's a history book on those kind of confessional regimes and clerical fascist states. And these things actually happen, and we can't just talk about ideas like ideas don't have consequences. And we don't just want to look at the American success story. These failure stories tell us a lot too. And maybe we come away thinking, oh, so, you know, the way Americans have done things are not so bad. If we're not a utopian and we take the best possible real world polity as Christians we can have and see the ways to make it better, that's better than being a utopian on the one hand or an illiberal establishmentarian, I think, on the other.
All right. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much for this. Now, is the book available as of now?
Yes.
Okay, good. Yeah.
Amazon, Barnes and Noble, you name it.
Acton.org. Yeah.
Oh, Target. Just Target
sells books.
Okay. You can order it from Target. That's what I said. But Josh answers yes.
Wow. Okay. I have it. If I can avoid Target, I will. I just I don't, there's something about it.
Oh, I don't think it would be on the shelf, but if you wanted, no. for some reason you decided Target's going to have a better delivery than Amazon on your porch 5 minutes after you order the book, you can go to Target.
Go for it. Well, thank you guys so much. Yeah, please check out the book, The Christian Roots of American Liberty, edited by Dylan and John. Thank you so much. There's a reservoir of conference topics in this book, frankly, and in this conversation we just had. So if you heard something that you're like, I'd like to talk more about that or dig deeper into that and present it at a spring conference in particular, I want to encourage you. The proposal deadline for that is September 1. And there's lots of things we could talk about. We kept mentioning Lactantius, for example. And as I recall, he is explicitly indebted to Cicero in particular. I just want to encourage you all to look into that. All right. You've been listening to The Sower, a production of the Ciceronian Society. As a reminder, we have a second podcast discussing Cicero's seminal work On Duties that is released every Wednesday morning. Be sure to take a look at that one as well. We also have the Fall Symposium, the Spring Conference, not to mention our journal, Pietas, the annual Herbert Storing Prize, the new Logres Institute, and much more. Make sure to sign up for our newsletter to stay on top of everything involving the Ciceronian Society. Don't forget to rate and review this podcast, share it with your friends, check out our website at ciceroniansociety.org, and thank you for listening.